Hey everyone, I'm Dan Sege from Hydro Ottawa, and I'll be hosting the Think Energy podcast. So here's today's big question. Are you looking to better understand the fast-changing world of energy? Join me every 2 weeks and get a unique perspective from industry leaders as we deep dive and discuss some of the coolest trends, emerging technologies, and latest innovations that drive the energy sector. So stay tuned as we explore some traditional and some quirky facets of this industry. This is the Think Energy Podcast. Hey everyone, welcome back. This is the Think Energy Podcast. What happens when you use a network of hot and cold water pipes, bury them underground, and then use them to efficiently heat and cool buildings, even whole communities? You get something called district energy. And it's not a new concept. A quick search will reveal that its origins can be traced back to the 2nd century BC, to the invention of the hypercost heating systems that powered the hot water bath of ancient Roman Empire. Famously, a hot water distribution system in Chaudes-Ingres in France is regarded as the first real district heating system. It used geothermal energy to provide heat for about 30 houses in the 14th century. And the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis began steam district heating in 1853. If you're like me, maybe you're wondering why modern civilization did not continue to use this efficient and environmentally sustainable technology more. There are some European countries, such as Denmark, where district energy is mandated, but for the most part, it is largely gone the way of ancient Rome and public bathing. The latter is not such a bad thing, in my mind. With more and more socially conscious citizens around the globe, district energy is once again seeing a surge in popularity and becoming a preferred method, thanks to its lower and energy-efficient operating costs, reduced supply disruptions, and environmentally sound methods of heating and cooling buildings. Municipalities and property owners are intrigued by this ancient alternative energy technology. So, here's today's big question. Is the world ready to embrace district energy as a viable means to power our communities? Is the nation's capital ready to have the first one planet zero carbon community district energy system in the country? Well, my guest today is the founding partner of the THEA Partnership, one of Canada's most sustainable real estate development companies, as well as the president of Zibi Canada, which aims to be Canada's most sustainable development project. He's also an active investor and entrepreneur in both environmental, clean tech, and real estate sector, with active investments in solar energy, site remediation, and the beneficial reuse of waste. Dear listeners, please welcome Jeff Westindy. Jeff, can we start by you telling us a bit about your background, the Zibi project, and what drives your passion to build sustainable communities?
Well, so I guess by background, I always say I'm an engineer by training, but an entrepreneur by practice. So I've had one, what I call real job in my career. I worked for a company for a little over a year. Quickly it became apparent that I was unemployable, so I had to start my own business. And I've always been in the environmental sector. So I started my career as an environmental contractor, cleaning up industrial messes and some of the wastes of the past. And as part of that, I would watch our clients, the way they were cleaning up properties and then what they would do to redevelop them. And I was pursuing trying to, you know, clean up the environment, make the planet a better place. And yet the practices we were using were actually making it worse. We're trucking contaminated soils. You know, at the time I lived in BC, we're picking up soil, putting it in a dump truck and hauling it across the Rocky Mountains into a landfill in Alberta. And nobody can tell me that's good for the environment. So very quickly decided that, or I shouldn't say very quickly, but decided, why don't I continue to move up the food chain and start to buy contaminated properties and start to develop places and communities. And because we were purchasing contaminated properties, the commitment that we had was, let's do better than we've done before. So let's push the envelope about how can we live in a sustainable way? How can we ensure that what we're building today doesn't cause the problems that we're cleaning up on the very site we're developing? So that's maybe a bit of a background as to, you know, why, how I got into this and my passion around, you know, leaving, it's like, I don't know if you're ever in the wilderness, but there's a rule, leave the campsite better than you found it. And I think that rule, that should be a planet-wide rule. And it historically, as you know, has not been so.
Okay, Jeff. You're on the record saying that the way we build communities does not support health, happiness, or the environment. What do you mean by that, and how does Zibi differentiate?
So I might even be so bold as to say that I would argue that most of our planning, especially in North America, is actually shortening the lifespan of our own citizens. And that's because we're so car reliant. We're so socially isolated in the way that we build. So think about a typical suburb. In a typical suburb, if you want to get up and, you know, go get a coffee, buy some milk, bring your kids to school, the very first thing you do is go hop in your car and drive. And that leads to, you know, there's stats that can predict the rate of diabetes, the rate of obesity, the rate of all sorts of other chronic diseases by the postal code you live in. Well, that's shocking. So this car-centric suburban lifestyle is not good for you. So that's the health side of it. The happiness side of it, I'll just point to one stat, and that's that there are statistics that say you can determine the level of happiness of somebody by how many of their neighbors they know by first name. Well, when you live in the suburbs, you know, you might know 2, 3, 4 neighbors, or those people whose kids are your age, or those guys you play hockey with. But you don't have these unexpected collisions as you're walking to the coffee shop or as you're bringing your kids to school. Again, that urban sprawl arguably leads to a lot of social isolation. And if something happens to you, an older person, you fall, you break a leg, even as a young person, and you're inside your house, similarly, you're not looking out your window and seeing people and waving at them and those types of things. So how we build our communities, I think, is really important for health, happiness, and obviously for environmental sustainability. What we're doing at Zibi is making sure that you will not be car-centric, that you do have these collisions with your neighbors as you're walking around the neighborhood. We actually have social programming that, you know, we have snowshoe nights and when Cirque du Soleil comes, we have a night that is just for the residents of Zibi that come. You know, those kinds of things to make sure you feel like a part of that community.
How did you discover the One Planet system? What can you tell us about it and your goal to build the first one in Canada?
So I'll talk about how we discovered it first, and that's that myself and my business partners were behind the very first LEED Platinum buildings in Canada. So we built the first LEED Platinum building in BC, Alberta, Ontario, and in the country as a whole. And the LEED Platinum building we built in Alberta, I was out visiting one day a couple of years after we'd built it. And LEED Platinum is literally the platinum standard, the most sustainable in the LEED system. And I watched one of the residents of this LEED Platinum condominium building drive a Hummer SUV into the parking garage and said, you know, it's great that our building's sustainable, but we really haven't impacted how the users are using the building and how they're living their lives. So we started scouring the planet, literally, to say, is there a system that would really impact not only how we build our buildings and how they operate at a point in time, but how do we engage the people, the users that are using those places? So One Planet, we get rated on things like health, and happiness. It's social engagement, along with all the other architectural and engineering features of a community. And the way One Planet works, very simple. The name says it all. We have to live as if we only have one planet. Most people, when I say that, look at me and sort of go, but we only do have one planet. And we need to remind them that if you live like a typical Canadian, you're using four planets of resources to sustain your unsustainable lifestyle. An American's using five planets. Europeans using three planets. And all we're doing is stealing from future generations and the developing world to sustain our unsustainable lifestyles. So One Planet really is all about both environmental sustainability, like technical sustainability, and social sustainability with one planet's worth of resources. And it's a very holistic program. Very audacious goals. We're going to talk about zero carbon. So as you know, ZB's in the nation's capital in Ottawa and Gatineau. We're going to be at plus 34 degrees. 6 months from now, we'll be at minus 34 degrees Celsius. And to be zero carbon in this environment, it's the holy grail. So achieving one planet is not an easy thing to do, very audacious. But that's where we said, no, that's the bar we need to hit. We need to, again, leave our campsite better than we came to it.
I was fascinated that this method, district energy, dates back, I think it's 3,000 or 4,000 years to the time of the Roman Empire. What are some of the key benefits of the energy system you're implementing in your community? And why has it taken this long for folks to embrace it with its being around for so long?
Well, like most technological breakthroughs, it is not the technology itself or even the concept itself that gets in the way. It's people. So regulators, if you look at how our grid works, say in Ontario, you cannot run a district electrical system. I couldn't produce energy and give it to my neighbor because we have a regulatory body that says we can't do that. And there's good reasons for that. It was around safety and security and all those types of things. But we've ended up with all of these barriers that would prohibit the transportation and sale of energy. I talked about electricity, but what's very interesting at ZB, our district energy system, is just hot and cold water. And there are no regulations currently in Ontario and Quebec around moving hot and cold water. So that allowed us to start a district energy system. The reason I would say you don't see more of them is the regulatory hurdles to implement a district energy system are enormous. However, the benefits are huge. I'll use a very, a high level example that if you were to have a Shopify data center, a good Canadian company, unlike Amazon has it, for instance, that is in constant cooling. So it's rejecting heating all the time, right? And beside it, you have the Nordique Spa, another great company that is always needs heating, but needs to therefore be rejecting cooling. Well, you put those two side by side, and they're swapping energy back and forth. So your load is so much less. That's the concept of district energy, is that by sharing, a commercial building has different loads than a residential building has different loads than a retail building. By sharing those loads, they have different peaks. You therefore peak shave. You have less capital expenditure and you're more efficient. Why has it taken so long? It drives me crazy, but I really do think it's regulation is the key item why.
Aside from regulation, what have been the challenges you encountered bringing this technology to market in Canada? The site of your One Planet community alone, straddling Ontario and Quebec, is really unique. Tell us about the challenges and how your passion has gotten you through.
Yeah, I'm not sure how long this podcast is, but I could talk for weeks about the challenges. As you talk about, we do span the provincial border between Ontario and Quebec. We jokingly say both sides have a different word for everything, because one speaks French, one speaks English. Even the rule of law is different one side or the other, the legal system. So, we need to repeat everything twice when we do this. But what I'll tell you is, I would say that the way that we've overcome what are just an enormous amount of challenges. I won't even get into what they all are because it's crazy. But the way we overcome it was we shared our vision, and actually I would say it was our community's vision of saying, this is where our region started. Arguably, this is where the roots of our country started, was on this site. When we purchased the property, it was a fenced off, locked off, contaminated former industrial site that nobody had seen unless you worked at EB Eddy or Domtar for probably 100 years. People didn't realize there was a waterfall in the middle of the city. What the community talked about and the vision that we had was, no, we need to do something truly world-class, like something that people would come to our region and say, Quebecers, Ontarians, Canadians, look at the communities and the places that they create. And with that vision of being world-class, we were fortunate that politicians in the region, federal, municipal, and provincial, all endorsed that, the community endorsed it. So when we started to bump up against bureaucracy and regulations, we were able to remind everybody that our commitment, our contract to all of our stakeholders was, we're going to do something world-class. Now, world-class means different. And bureaucracies and regulations exist to enforce the same. So we were able to say, listen, you've got to empower, talk to the politicians, you've got to empower the bureaucrats who are paid to make sure that everybody does everything the same, to say, no, we've got to look at this one differently. We're not looking to do anything unsafe or unreasonable, but there's a better way, we've got to find it. And it was really that vision of world class and the endorsement that we got from all of the public stakeholders who said, yeah, we want to be world class. We don't want to just build another suburb of the city of Ottawa or Gatineau. So
now, through marketing lens, how did you position this alternative energy system that provides heating and cooling to your community's new housing projects? What was the value proposition for prospective buyers and investors?
I think the key one of the lessons we've learned about sustainability and building sustainable buildings and building sustainable communities is most consumers don't, you know, while it's a nice to have being sustainable, it's not something that they're making a purchasing decision around. That's changing. I think more and more people are starting to look at that, but historically it hasn't been important. So the key with sustainability is we need to, the way we've marketed is, listen, we're going to allow you to be much more environmentally sustainable, socially sustainable without any impact to your lifestyle. So when it comes to district heating and cooling, we said, listen, we're going to deliver you zero carbon district heating and cooling at the same market cost as a carbon-based system, and you won't know. You're going to turn your heat on, it's going to get hot. You're going to turn your cooling on, it's going to get cool, and you're not going to pay any more than market. So that was that marketing. I mean, that's a no-brainer to everybody that, okay, hold on. I get the exact same as I would get in a carbon-based system, but I'm zero carbon, I'm more sustainable. That's a pretty easy sell at that point in time.
Okay. Now I'd like to explore design aspects. District energy equipment inside a building occupies about one-fifth of the area of conventional systems that boilers and chillers take up. I'm assuming this provides more flexibility in designing your buildings and community. By eliminating traditional HVAC systems, what building design options did this enable you to expand on?
There's some easy ones. Like if you think about rooftop patios, as a for instance, you know, if you have a rooftop patio beside a big chiller that's making a bunch of noise, it's not a great rooftop. So by being able to eliminate that equipment, our rooftop patios are much nicer. But really, as a placemaker, as a developer, the key aspect for us was if you take all of that mechanical and electrical distribution space, and you end up with instead real estate that you can use, it's another added benefit to saying that. District energy makes financial sense, or can make financial sense. It wasn't easy to unlock that, but can make financial sense. So Obviously, the less constraints you have on a building, the more flexibility you have, and district is one tool for that for sure.
Now, wondering if you could zero in on the energy distribution system that harnesses excess heat from the Kruger paper mill on the Ottawa River and the temporary thermal plant that was or is built to serve residents and businesses in your community.
Sure. Yeah. So I talked about the benefits the rationale behind district, that if you have different energy cycles between neighboring buildings, you can share that energy. Our district energy system is actually based on that very same principle that Kruger operates a tissue mill directly across from Parliament Hill. Very efficient, very successful mill. But as part of that process, they bring in millions of liters of water a day, heated up to over 40 degrees Celsius, use it several times in their papermaking process, but then discharge it into the Ottawa River at about 30 degrees Celsius, anywhere from 25 to 30. So what we're doing is saying, listen, you're discharging these millions of liters of hot water into the Ottawa River. Why don't we strip that heat? So then what we're doing is we're taking it from 25 to 30 degrees down to 7 to 10 degrees and discharging that into the Ottawa River in our heating system or in the heating season. So that's the concept behind it. It's very rudimentary engineering. It's strictly heat transfer between water. So pretty straightforward from that point of view. The temporary plant that you speak about is our district energy system. That backbone heating system at Kruger is not yet built. That's getting built this season. However, we have users in our buildings right now, so we have temporary plants that are providing that. But the infrastructure for the district, the pipes in the streets and the hot and cold water system is there. So those temporary plants are going to operate for about another year, after which we'll be on our permanent system.
In addition to reducing greenhouse gas emissions and improving energy resilience, is it fair to say that district energy deliver economies of scale in areas with high population? What are some of the short and long-term benefits for the owner and end user alike? And how does these factors into the government carbon reduction targets?
Well, yeah, so the short term is if you can be more efficient. So if you have dense populations with different energy cycles, so different peaks and whatnot, as we talked about earlier, you need to spend less capital because your peaking is at a lower level, and you're sharing energy between, so that your overall initial energy utilization from the grid or from the gas system is lower because you're sharing more. So overall, that drives efficiency. And at the end of the day, efficiency then drives lower greenhouse gas emissions and ideally lower and more stable costs, because if your energy inputs are a lower percentage of the overall district. So say in our case, if we're harnessing heat from Kruger, there is no escalation in the cost of that heat. It's waste industrial heat that otherwise wouldn't go anywhere. Whereas if we're connected to the Ontario grid, as you know, costs have escalated very significantly. So that energy input, if that is our key input, our energy costs are going to be higher. So we're fortunate that again, the combination of we sit in Ontario and in Quebec, so we have two different electrical and two different gas grids. We have waste heat and our cooling is going to come largely from the Ottawa River. So we have low cost inputs with waste heat and Ottawa River cooling. And we have four different grids we can tap into for other energy if need be. So that then allows us to control our costs. So again, just an example of how you can drive efficiency, provide more price stability while at the same time reducing emissions.
Okay. Does alternative energy sources like district energy reduced exposure to fluctuating energy prices? How are the rates, costs determined for residents? Are they comparable to current rates, and are they stable?
Yeah. So, yes, not all district energy systems are the same. Obviously, it depends on what those inputs are. But in the case of the ZB community utility, our district energy system, then our key inputs are that waste industrial heat and cooling base from the Ottawa River, both of which obviously are stable. We have some commercial transactions that go on with that, but not like the grid. That allows us to decrease our reliance on the grid for other inputs. To answer the question on rates, yes, our rates are comparable to market, and we've actually indexed them to the price of Quebec Hydro electricity. And for anyone that understands electrical grids, I would suggest that in North America, Quebec is likely the most stable grid in all of North America. I would say that it is a national utility for the province of Quebec, and I would say, all Canadians are very proud of our healthcare, and if they ever tried to take it away, there'd be riots in the streets. I would suggest that if anybody tried to raise electrical rates in Quebec, similar to what's happened in Ontario, there would be even bigger riots in the streets. So, we are expecting that will allow us to provide really stable pricing over the long term to our customers.
Now, how important was it to find a strategic partner like Hydro Ottawa that had more than 100 years of experience and a strong track record to create safe and reliable utility infrastructure?
The partnership with Hydro Ottawa was critical. And again, consumer acceptance of that, of the district energy system. If you think about reliability, if you're a consumer at ZB and you said, okay, well, what happens if my heating or cooling goes off? Who do I call? If I said, well, I am Jeff and here's my cell phone, call me up at the cottage and I'll see if I can help you. That's not exactly reassuring. When you say, oh, well, you call Ottawa Hydro, and they, well, isn't that who I would normally? Yeah, no, reliability stats of Hydro Ottawa better than me, but it's 99.999 something percent uptime, 24 hour response, et cetera, et cetera. Being able to bring that credibility of a utility operator to our district was absolutely critical for overall consumer acceptance, and I would even say regulatory acceptance. When we start talking about, listen, we're going to be moving hot and cold water in the, energy in the form of hot and cold water around the around our community. All municipal officials, provincial, did you have experience with this? When we say, well, Hydro Ottawa is our partner, it is an automatic acceptance of, oh, no, okay, you guys are credible. We understand. Let's carry on. Having Hydro as a partner has been truly exceptional for us to be able to pioneer this.
Jeff, in addition to district energy, what else is ZB planning to feature in terms of other advanced technology and innovation to achieve zero carbon living for the residents and tenants on the site?
Yeah, again, I know your podcast is not that long, so I could talk forever about this, but I'll give you some key examples. So, trying to decrease reliance on carbon-based transportation systems. The personal vehicle, having car sharing, having excellent access to transit. When you look at other things that have a carbon footprint, how we build our buildings, the components that go into our buildings, the materials that go into our buildings, some are very carbon intensive. So again, we're targeting those that aren't carbon intensive. Even things like if you look at logistics, when you buy a head of lettuce at the grocery store, the carbon it took to get that lettuce to the grocery store is embedded in that very product. So having urban agriculture, you'll see urban gardens. We've got a couple on site now. So all sorts of areas where anywhere where we can target things that are that use carbon to get delivered to or to as part of the system that we're in, we're looking at incrementally changing all of those things, and those increments, when they add up, turn into some big numbers. So that's really our focus.
Jeff, how about we close off with some rapid fire questions? Are you ready to go?
Ready, Dan.
What is your favorite word?
Serendipity. Yeah, I love serendipity because good things happen when you're not paying attention.
What is one thing you can't live without?
Well, that's an easy one. My wife. I'd be dead without that woman.
What is something that challenges you?
The word no. I'm not good at taking the word no. It's how ZB exists.
If you could have one superpower, what would it be?
I'd love to be a shapeshifter. Be able to get inside different systems, different beings, and understand how and why they work. I have endless curiosity, so I think being a shapeshifter would be amazing.
If you had to turn back time and talk to your 18-year-old self, what would you tell him?
First, I would say smarten up and stop doing all those dumb things. But no, I think the one thing I would say is, listen, relax. You know, something that has come to ring true with me, the Roman philosopher Seneca said, you know, luck happens when opportunity meets preparedness. And I've been very fortunate to be lucky, but there's only one thing I can control in there. I can't control luck. I can't control opportunity. All I can do is control preparedness. So get prepared and just relax. Pay attention. Good things will happen.
And lastly, what do you currently find most interesting in your sector?
I love the fact that public health, so right now, you know, as you know, we're in the middle of a COVID pandemic. Public health is leading that across, well, actually across our country, but here in Ottawa, it's Vera Etchez. I love the fact that our public health officials are starting to be included in our public, in our urban planning policies. So in Ottawa, Vera Etchez participated in that. So remember I said earlier, you know, the way we plan is shortening the lifespan of our citizens. Public health starting to get involved in that. I'm really hoping that there will be an influence where they'll say, if we plan communities this way, then here's the health benefits of it. If we do it that way, here's the health benefits. So that's not currently happening. So I find that really exciting.
Well, Jeff, we've reached the end of another episode of the Think Energy podcast. Last question for you. How can our listeners learn more about you and Zibi? How can they better connect?
You know, we've been talking mostly about the ZB project, which is one of the many things I do. You know, if you go to ZB.ca, then, or ZB.ca, sorry, I'm speaking bilingually there for a second, then you can find more about ZB. And if you go to hello@zb.ca, anybody that wants to connect, they're very good at getting people to me. I'm not much of a social media person. I do have a LinkedIn profile. I don't use it very often, but you can find me on LinkedIn and I'm good at responding to messages there as well.
Again, thank you so much for joining me today. I hope you had a lot of fun.
Well, this was fun, Dan, and thank you for your interest in ZB and One Planet. That's fantastic.
Thank you for joining us today. I truly hope you enjoyed this episode of the Think Energy podcast. For past episodes, make sure you visit our website, hydroottawa.com/podcast. Lastly, if you found value in this podcast, be sure to subscribe. Anyway, this podcast is a wrap. Cheers, everyone.